Women's Health Melbourne is an innovative, holistic fertility and women's health practice. We are world leaders in IVF and egg freezing and provide our patients with every opportunity to achieve their goals.
Our hand-picked, expert team provides the ultimate care experience for our patients. Reach us at womenshealthmelbourne.com.au and follow us at Women's Health Melbourne and at Dr. Raylia Liu. Hello, and welcome back to Knocked Up, the podcast about fertility and women's health. You are joined, as always, by me, Geordie Morrison, and Dr. Raylia Liu, CREI Fertility Specialist. Welcome, Raylia.
Hi, Geordie. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Raylia. And today we've got a guest, Dr. Rebecca McKenzie Proctor. Welcome, Rebecca. Welcome, Rebecca. Do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Thank you, Geordie. It's lovely to be here. And so it's beautiful to be part of the Women's Health Melbourne team. Coming here has been a really wonderful experience, being able to join a group of fertility specialists that are in line with my values and my holistic approach to patients. I have finished my consultancy training in the FransCog, which makes me a gynecologist and obstetrician. And then I've taken a further 3 years extra study on top of that to become a CREI specialist. And parts of that I did in New Zealand, and other parts of it I'm doing over here in Australia. So it's a really big special commitment that we take for our patients. We want to learn a lot more and a lot more in depth nature about fertility. And it's something I've been really enjoyed undertaking.
So Rebecca is a practicing fertility specialist with training as a subspecialist in the CREI qualification in the final stages, and she has been such an amazing addition to our practice at Women's Health Melbourne, taking such care of our patients together, which has been so lovely. Also, Rebecca, to have your perspective on things as a Kiwi.
Thank you.
Which is a lovely viewpoint to contrast to our Australian training. So I've learned from you as well.
Now, Rebecca, the reason we're talking to you today is that it's Men's Health Month and you have a particular interest in male fertility.
It's a good question, Geordie. Yeah, that is an interesting way, a little adventure that I went on. And it actually started way back at med school. I remember in my fifth year at medical school, a couple of my friends were having a lot of difficulty conceiving, and I was thinking, and they were beating themselves up about how hard it was and it was all their fault, and they're feeling really down about themselves. They're like, there must be something more to this. And of course, being a fresh, not even a qualified doctor yet, I didn't know really much about the specialty. And then I started delving into male infertility, and I started getting involved in research, looking at some of the factors that could affect fertility, starting off with sort of looking at lifestyle issues as well. And it really just blossomed from there. And and also with some of the population in New Zealand, the Māori Pacific Islanders, I've got to work with some people who are struggling really hard with male infertility, and also the cultural aspects. And it really made me interested about the holistic nature of how male infertility is not just about not being able to conceive due to your health reasons. It's also a whole look at your some people's masculinity or how they feel about themselves. And it's a lot more than that. So being able to kind of understand and help patients, that's sort of really what got me into it.
And what is male infertility?
So male infertility is when the issue that's causing fertility for a couple is usually based purely on male aspects. So we think that everything about the female is being found to be normal. There's no issues with their tubes, their ovaries, their ovulation, their health, and that we've found some sort of factor that is related to the man. So whether it might be their sperm or their hormones or something else.
It might interest our listeners to know the frequency of male factor infertility as well, because quite often people think of fertility as a woman's issue. What's exactly the frequency of male infertility, Rebecca? Tell our listeners.
Oh, really? It's exactly right. I mean, that's one of the big things I was saying to you. Actually, I always tell my patients it's a third, a third, a third. So a third of the time it's the female, a third of the time it's the male, and a third of the time it's the couple in general. So it's actually a really high proportion. It's equal amount for the female and the male. So we should almost have equal focus. And also remembering that actually 1 in 20 men will have a low sperm count. Doesn't mean they're infertile, but that's a lot of people that could potentially be affected by infertility from the male perspective. 1 in 100 people will potentially have no sperm at all.
So how are we finding out they don't have sperm?
It's actually really cruel in some aspects in our current guidelines, because our current guidelines for young couples who are under 35 who are trying to conceive through natural means is to do a sperm test after a year. So unless somebody's proactive, they could be actually trying for a year with no sperm, theoretically, with our current guidelines. I'm always very proactive, and I actually disagree with this current guideline. I think, look, particularly for women over 35, because our reproductive time is ticking, but I think for all couples trying to conceive, it's really reasonable to consider knowing about male factor concerns. Perhaps not immediately before even trying, but certainly the guidelines for couples who are over 35 is to check it out after 6 months, and I would argue that that would be very reasonable for everybody.
I would totally agree, really. And I think another aspect of that is if you find that there's a problem with the sperm, you've got time to fix it before they're even trying. So it's kind of like, why not have, if you have a woman's health check, why not have a man's health check too, to make sure that you're both kind of on the best foot forward when you're thinking actually about trying to conceive.
And who wants to do the gruesome job of telling us about the sperm test?
It's not really gruesome, Geordie. It's actually really easy. I mean, think about, I was just thinking this the other day, you know, I was thinking about the things that women go through, you know, to have a cervical smear, to, you know, have a gynecological examination or a pelvic ultrasound. Really, to do a semen analysis, a man has to ejaculate into a cup. And it's not that hard. Like, it can be a little bit uncomfortable, I'm sure, and it can be a bit confronting, but I think most would agree it's not a painful thing to have to do.
Nothing like a smear, that is for sure.
But I think even like a leg wax, you know, like women do so many things that are just so much more uncomfortable.
Exactly. They just have to, you know, ejaculate into a cup, maybe in a funny room somewhere, maybe with something funny around them, some noise as a bus going past, but it's not the worst thing in the world. The other thing that I think is really funny when I think about providing a semen sample is the timing of getting the semen sample to the lab, and the stories about people driving across town and this, you know, got their sperm between their legs trying to keep it warm while they're, you know, they're racing through the red light, you know, because we have to get sperm to the lab at this particular time after the sample's been made to kind of get the best possible analysis of the sperm. So it's, there is a definitely a time critical nature.
Okay, so maybe let's talk about what can cause male fertility. I'm sure there's some unusual causes, but what are the most common causes of male infertility?
What I was saying before about the sperm count, it's also just really important to remember that you can have low sperm and it doesn't mean that you're infertile. But of course, having low sperm is one of the most common reasons. So sort of low numbers, the abnormal production of the sperm, thinking about blockages. So there's obviously lots of potential causes, and so there's lots of different ways as doctors we sort of divide this up for our patients. So you can either think about, is it a testicular problem? Is it a brain problem, a pre-testicular problem, or is it kind of an overall body problem? And looking at the testicular problems, we used to call it obstructive and non-obstructive. So if you think about the sperm is made in the testicle. It is then travels up to the epididymis, that little cap on top of the testicle, and it's stored there. And then it's got to get from there all the way out in the ejaculate. So you can imagine there can be blockages along this way, along the way here. So you can have a blockage sort of in the bath somewhere. That's probably one of the most common causes for obstructive, well, it is what is obstructive infertility. And probably the most common cause for that is someone's done it themselves, they had a vasectomy. So when you have a vasectomy, you cut that tube, no more sperm can come out. You're still making the sperm, it's still there, but it's just got no pathway to get out. Other things that can cause that would be infections like STIs, sort of the silent cause of male infertility. Former surgery in that area can be a big reason. And then, of course, thinking about the actual production of the sperm itself. So what do we need to make sperm? We need hormones, we need testosterone. So people who have may have issues with making testosterone or taking testosterone is another cause. Anabolic steroids stops the normal production of testosterone. The most common cause actually is something else called varicocele. And it means like varicose veins in the testicle. And about 40% of people with male infertility will have a varicocele.
It is quite a high number, but of course there's also some other just genetic causes that people just have bad sperm. They just genetically make bad sperm. Or not enough.
Exactly, and that's something that's really important in a population to look at. You know, we're now doing genetic screening for women. We're also thinking about what is it about the man. And some of those causes too, let's remember, it's not just about the sperm. So we, as holistic fertility specialists, we need to look at the fact that why is this the problem? What are the other health consequences of having the bad sperm or the no sperm?
And how do you assess that?
The first things first, as we talked about, was doing a sperm analysis or a semen analysis. And so we do the first one. Once we get that result back, we look at all the different components. So a sperm test is not just looking at the volume or something. There's lots of little parts of it. It's like a little bit like reading a book. We can look at the different things and it can give us different information about what might be going on for a patient. So we'll look at the volume, if it's a high volume or low volume, and that tells us sort of about the function of the tube as well. Has it got the prostate making enough fluid? Then we look at the concentration, so the number of sperm, and that then tells us if it's high or normal. Or is it kind of in the middle? We call that oligospermia or low sperm, oligospermia, or azoospermia, which is when there's no sperm. Then we'll look at the motility of the sperm. So are they moving at all? Are there any moving? And are they moving forward? So there's different parameters, and what is their total number moving and what is the total number not moving? So we sort of, as you can see, it's building a bit of a puzzle here, putting all that information together. And sometimes we'll look at the pH as well of the sample, and the total motile sperm kind of can come from that too. And then the final thing is, what does it look like? So what is our morphology of the sperm? We have guidelines, so the World Health Organization guidelines that we've now follow to work out our cutoffs. And we can talk to patients about that and what that might mean.
Well, the way that I think patients should consider the WHO guidelines and the reference ranges for sperm tests is that we are really, with those reference ranges, the bottom end of normal is really the bottom end. So we hope that most men will be way above that bottom number. So for example, with the sperm count, we have a cutoff of 15 million per mil as being normal, but that's the fifth centile of the fertile population, and most guys will walk in with hundreds of millions of sperm in their sperm count per mil. That would be more normal. So when we look at those cutoffs, we've set them for a reason, and if you're well below those cutoffs, it is quite serious.
Absolutely, and I think that's kind of what we're talking about with that whole picture of looking at everything together and kind of seeing where are all the numbers. Are they close to that sort of cutoff, or are they way above it?
Yeah, and I think an important thing to just note there also is that patients read about things online before we end up seeing them, and they read about the different fertility treatment options that we can offer today. And it's important to know that while you can read a textbook or an article online about different options, there are biological limitations as to whether an option might be suitable for a person. So, for example, I will have patients who misunderstand that and come in with a male partner who's got a really low sperm count and say, oh, doctor, can I have IUI or artificial insemination? I have to say, no, you can't. The only way that you can get pregnant at all with this type of sperm count is going to be IVF and ICSI. There's no other option. The other option is to use donor sperm or to decide not to have a baby. That can be quite confronting. The male factor infertility can mean that from the point of view of a relationship, that a female has the burden of a lot of fertility treatment because we need to take eggs out of the body in order to use very low sperm samples to fertilize an egg. I guess also, Rebecca, when we talk holistically, the general health of a male can affect their fertility. Tell us a bit about your viewpoint on that.
That's a really good point, and it's something that's definitely a lot more focused on, hopefully, in society. So our environment has a huge impact on our fertility and our overall health. And so for a man especially, the things that you need to be looking at for them is looking at their BMI, what is their weight status. That can affect their testosterone production. You've got to think about smoking really affects sperm health as well, different medications that they're on, heat, excessive heat around the testicles. So people who are doing extreme biking, I notice having low sperm. So all of those little things are really important to remember, that too much heat in that area can affect the sperm quite considerably. Other things within the environment to think about is your toxic load from what we call endocrine disruptors. So an endocrine disruptor is something that affects that hormone production for a patient. It happens for men and for women. And we can find them in our environment, and almost everything that we touch has some sort of potential endocrine disruptor. the biggest thing for patients, or I'll tell them, is about their relationship with plastic, what we think of the biggest endocrine disruptor, apart from pesticides and, you know, those obvious things that are going to potentially kill your sperm. But in your everyday life, you touch plastic in everything. You know, the receipt that you grab from after being in the supermarket has got an endocrine disrupting properties to it. You put your food up in a plastic container, it leaches plastic out of it into your food. Your food is then contaminated by a potential endocrine disruptor. You know, everywhere you go, your jacket's got flame retardant on it. You know, there's just, it's never ending. And I don't want to scare people out there, but it's really thinking about, how do you detoxify your life? How do you take some of these things out? Another area is what you eat. So making sure you've got a good diet of leafy green vegetables, a balanced amount of protein, and of course, a balanced amount of carbohydrates too. And alcohol, obvious one. Try to kind of reduce your amount of alcohol intake. Binge drinking has got a huge impact on the sperm quality, as well as recreational drugs.
And Rebecca, as a Melburnian talking to a Kiwi, what about coffee?
I know. Well, I hate to tell people about coffee because I love coffee so much myself. So actually, coffee is an interesting one, because yes, if you have too much coffee, it affects your system, your ability to process hormones. But caffeine actually has a positive effect on sperm sometimes, and can increase their kind of their ability to move. So if you've got a motility issue, it's a funny thing. Coffee's good.
I also want to ask you, Rebecca, about one little pink elephant in many men's rooms these days. Hair loss, because a lot of modern men are very worried about losing their hair and take actions, often medical actions. And even these days, there are even startups online where you can order medications without seeing a doctor who holistically cares for you to try and reduce hair loss. How do hair loss medications affect fertility?
Depends on which hair loss treatments you're using. A lot of people use the sort of, is it biotin? That's one of probably most common. Yes, I think there is evidence now to show that some of those treatments will affect your ability to conceive. But we've got to be really careful that we're not affecting the next offspring or our goal to get pregnant. So finasteride is one of the medications that people will be taking to try to stop the hair loss. And unfortunately, this has an anti-androgen. So any anti-androgen, especially if anything that you see that says anti-androgen, is a problem. It's going to affect your body's natural ability to make the sperm it needs to make, which is made from the androgen, the testosterone hormone. And so if you're stopping that process from happening by taking something anti-androgen, that's anti-testosterone or anti-hormone, then of course you are going to affect that whole process within your body. If you are thinking about trying to conceive and you are thinking about taking these medications, you really talk to one of us that can guide you through that, or just don't take it at all. And so I think if you are questioning that, or you're buying something online, really important to talk to a fertility specialist or a GP.
Yeah, and also let us know, because like a lot of people won't volunteer that information, or they won't consider it a medication, whereas it can be the minoxidils, the finasteride, oral medications. And it may be that we can, if someone's really, really worried and really nervous about hair loss, we can maybe give them some advice or reach a compromise, maybe allowing continuation of topical therapy and cessation of oral therapy. There are also some hair loss treatments emerging, like PRP injection to the scalp, which is really fertility friendly and can't possibly affect your sperm adversely. So it might be that you stop one type of therapy for a while and use another type of therapy instead for a while you're trying to conceive. And everything that we put into our system and every dietary change and lifestyle change does take time to reach the sperm. Rebecca, do you want to outline for our listeners how long it takes men to create a batch of sperm?
Sperm are regenerating all the time, as opposed to women whose eggs are what they had when they were inside their mother's tummy and have got the same eggs all the way through. Men have the advantage of their sperm regenerating every approximately 72 days, is what I was taught at medical school, and is kind of around the figure that we always use. It can kind of be give or take. So I usually say to a patient that it's between 2 and 3 months. The longer the better if you're thinking about wanting to make a change, because you're getting more than one wave of sperm being developed.
So basically good behavior has to be sustained for at least 3 months to see a benefit.
100%. that's another thing to remember, that if you've got rubbish sperm in a sample, it doesn't mean it's rubbish forever. You've got lots of opportunities to change your health, change your life, and make it better.
I always say that to patients. I always say we can't tell if it's a personal best or a bad day when we look at one sample, and we need to look at least two samples separated by at least 6 weeks to see a bit of context and know if that sperm sample is representative of their best self or whether or not it might just be a bad day for them.
I want to ask, you've got a patient in front of you who has low or no sperm. As a fertility specialist, what do you do to help this couple have a child?
And that's something that we're faced with on a daily basis, Geordie. So it's a big deal, and it's, as I said, it's a third of the patients that we see have this problem. So to start off, you know, once we've assessed everything, I've said we've done the sperm samples, I'll talk to them about the sperm sample. I'll go through each step of the way. I'll look at the concentration, the motility, the volume, and see for them, so they can really understand what their problem is. I think the first thing is understanding what a potential problem could be. But then we need to look at a bit more investigations to find out a little bit more details about what it could be. And as we alluded to earlier, you know, there's causes, there's the genetic causes, there's the hormonal causes, there's obviously the lifestyle causes, and there's other medical issues that can kind of relate to the sperm production. So we then need to do a little bit deeper into the investigation. So I would organise a hormonal profiling, looking at the FSH levels, LH, testosterone, depending on the medical background, a few other hormones that I'll also assess as well. And one, a genetic screening panel. There are some specific genetic conditions that can lead to infertility, especially from the male factor. A big one of which is the CFTR or cystic fibrosis gene, which is probably one of the most common genetic conditions that we carry in our society. Another issue is looking at sort of some deletions within the Y chromosome is another one, or even just having the wrong chromosomes altogether. In terms of looking at genetic causes, Klinefelter's is the most common genetic condition that we look for, and we find that in a karyotype. And then we need to think about how we're going to find sperm. If we've got no sperm at all, there's various things that we can do. And that's something that I've really specialise myself in understanding and trying to help patients with, is getting sperm from patients who have no sperm. And there's two ways we can do this or try to do this, the first of which is looking at medications. So can we give them treatments similar to what we give someone during an IVF cycle to see if we can regenerate their sperm? The process is not a short process, so it's really important for patients and people to understand that it's not like I give you a medication and tomorrow your sperm's coming back. We've got to remember that we've got the 72-day lag to start with. So you've always got at least 3 months of taking something to see an effect. And then if the deficit is worse, it can take longer. So it can take up for some patients who have been using anabolic steroids, for instance, can almost take up to 2 years to get a sperm count that is acceptable for conception. I mean, that's the very extreme, but it's, you know, people have got to realise that it can take time.
And I think it's important just for our listeners to let everybody know that not everybody can have sperm returned to the ejaculate with hormone therapy, and how we choose candidates for that type of therapy is looking to see that the problem is actually a hormone problem. If it's a messenger problem, we start the communication back to the testis to get the factory making sperm. That is not something that we can do if the hormones are not lacking. For a particular group of patients that might have a cause of a sperm suppression that is of a hormonal nature. There's a group of patients who have no sperm in the ejaculate, and all their hormones tell us that it's a testicle problem. For some of those patients, there will be a tiny area, even though most of their testis is not making any sperm, there might be a tiny area or a little patch of tissue, of little tubules where sperm are being made in their testis. And sometimes we want to find that tiny little area to see if we can use it in IVF. That involves surgical exploration of the testis. It's a big deal. The testis needs to be cut open, and with a microscope, a skilled surgeon looks through every little bit of tissue to see if we can find any sperm at all. And if we do find that sperm, it might be able to be used in IVF through a technique called ICSI. So when I do that type of treatment planning with my patients, I tend to freeze a lot of eggs before I get going, because we want to be able to use every single sperm we find, and we want to tee everything up so that our timing aligns with a planned surgery. And it can be that if a man has a microtesy or a testicular exploration, that his testis may have consequences afterwards. It may never work again. And he may need hormone therapy for the rest of his life. So it is a very extreme undertaking. There's another area that sometimes our patients don't tell us about that might be affecting their fertility as a couple, and that's sexual function. Because obviously you have to have sex to get pregnant. And not only do you have to have sex to get pregnant, you have to get sex when you're ovulating to get pregnant. And everything else has to be all right. Some people have trouble having sex, and that can be part of their major issue in terms of having a pregnancy with their partner, if not an entire issue. How do you talk to men about trouble having sex?
It is definitely a hard thing to bring up, and trying to create an environment that the patient feels comfortable talking about that is the first step. So it wouldn't be the first thing I'd say to a patient when they come in, oh, you know, how are you doing it and how's it happening? So it's sort of a building process, but it's also just having to use the words. I need to make sure that the patients also feel comfortable being able to say the things to me. So I'll often talk to them about, you know, in terms of having sex, what's the timing? When are you doing it? How are you planning it? And are there any problems on either side? Is there any pain? Ejaculation issues, I'll just say it straight up. Are you able to ejaculate? How do you feel about sex? I'll often ask them, what do you feel? Do you have a libido? Do you feel like this is just a chore? Or do you have a drive and a desire to want to have sex? And are there any problems? Also, looking at that, there are some medical conditions that can mean that some people will have issues with being able to even get an erection. And there are medications that can take and affect that too, and also ejaculate. So it's definitely a big deal. And of course, if the sperm's not getting where it needs to go, then that's your fertility problem sorted. So what to do about this for people? It's not just as easy as, oh, here we go, we've got the problem, now we know, now we'll go fix it. Sexual dysfunction for a man is huge, and it's sort of unpacking that for them, finding a place where they can actually talk to someone. We've got these wonderful sexual counsellors out there, or people they can try to talk to kind of go through some of the issues. If, you know, it might be premature ejaculation, delayed ejaculation, or anejaculation, or erectile dysfunction. And so kind of working out those things, is it something that it's psychological? Is it physical? You know, delving a bit deeper once I've sort of had that initial information being given to me is important, and ensuring to the male too that this is okay, that he's not the only person out there that might be feeling that. So,
yeah, it's actually really common. My approach to it's very similar. I have really a look at the biological, I have a look at the psychological, and then I think about the solution. So some couples just don't want to have sex. Like, we make the assumption that couples want to have sex, but some couples are perfectly happy in their relationship and they don't have a very sexual relationship. So sometimes we look at the biological, which is, are there any underlying factors? Are there medications that are adversely affecting libido? Famously, SSRIs, which is a type of antidepressant, can really affect libido and can cause erectile dysfunction that a lot of people are on. But also, you know, what do they want? Because if what they want is to be pregnant and have a baby, and that having sex, you know, kind of once on the weekend, as I generally recommend around ovulation for patients getting their groove on to try and have a baby, maybe that's not their agenda. Their agenda is to try and just get pregnant. And we can help with assisted reproduction for that. You actually, in this day and age, don't have to have sex to have a baby.
Now, Rebecca, I think we could probably talk to you about this all day, but we have to get on with seeing patients. I have one last question for you, and it's about myths and male infertility. Is there a myth that you think we need to dispel?
I think one of the big things is testosterone. So as we know, testosterone is the male hormone, the hormone that sort of makes you manly and deepens your voice and makes your hair grow and all those things that are meant to be manly. And people think, well, okay, if I haven't got enough sperm, maybe, or I wanted my libido to be a bit better, I'll take some testosterone. You know, that will make me more manly, that will make me be able to conceive perfectly, of course. unfortunately, this is 100% the opposite problem. People don't take in testosterone, whether or not it's because you are wanting to bodybuild or you're just wanting a bit more libido. There's lots and lots of reasons why people are wanting to take testosterone or testosterone-like substances. So there's lots of protein powders or certain things out there, over-the-counter remedies that actually contain testosterone-like products in them. So you've got to be a bit careful with that as well. And the problem is that once you're taking it inside your body, the testicles no longer think they need to make it, because the messages that come to them from the brain say, hey, I've already got enough of this, let's not make any more. And so the more they have this message not coming to them, they're like, oh, well, let's just give up. And they slowly stop making anything at all, and the testicles actually will even shrink in size. So someone who's been using anabolic steroids for a long time may actually have really small testicles. They may have big body everywhere else, big muscles, big everything else, but small testicles, and that's because they've just given up. They've said, no need to do it anymore. Someone else is doing it for me. So that's the biggest myth, would be like, be careful with what you are taking inside your body.
Great advice. Thank you so much, Rebecca. And thank you, Raelia.
To support Knocked Up, leave us a review or recommend to a friend. Join us on Instagram at Knocked Up Podcast and join Raelia at Dr. Raelia Liu. And email us your questions to podcast@womenshealthmelbourne.com.au.